Welcome back, EPL Talk Pro subscribers, and I welcome you with a warning. This first part is going to seem obscure, possibly cliched or even irrelevant, but it is relevant, especially in a historical sense. Because by the time 1980 came along, hip-hop music, particularly in and around New York City, had enough influence to catch the eye of people looking to make money off of it. And I suppose that's a tipping point of any cultural movement, at least in this day and age. Do people see it being significant enough to make it marketable? 21 years ago, Sylvia and Joe Robinson, a wife and husband who had been part of the music industry since the 1960s, saw the synthesis of rap, DJ scratching, and general urban culture as a moneymaker. In 1970, they founded Sugar Hill Records and brought three, and there's really no other way to describe them, guys together. Wonder Mike, Big Bang Hank, and Master G. They were the Sugar Hill Gang. They released Rapper's Delight through Sugar Hill Records, and by 1980, they had hip-hop's first ever Billboard Top 40 single. Now, for those who are even vaguely familiar with the history of hip-hop, allusions to the Sugar Hill Gang are this strange combination of trite and tiresome, yet undeniably historically relevant. You see, Sugar Hill Gang's place as hip-hop pioneers is undisputed. But that status is as much attributable to timing as substance. Nobody will describe any of the gang's MCs as especially skilled or influential, yet nobody would ever denigrate what they did. True, they were the tool of Sugar Hill Records, that thing that would be Joe and Sylvia Robinson's big label's big break. But ultimately, and this is something that is tough to say, the song and Sugar Hill Gang's skills just don't hold up. With hindsight, the song does seem trite, more of a milestone in a movement's ascendancy than something that has artistic value independent of some kind of temporal context. But even if we engage in a worst-case scenario and concede that there isn't much artistic value in Rapper's Delight, there is still huge historical value in noting its place in the history of hip-hop, value that brings us back to what you've all presumably tuned in for, something regarding football. In our first edition of Detailing the Pyramid, we focused on how we got here, looking at how we built to this point in time where English language coverage of tactics and the demand for that coverage has reached an all-time high. Today, we focus on a different point in time, the present. What is the current state of football coverage, specifically as it concerns tactics? What are the effects, the products, the problems? Where are we at this moment in this change in football culture? Are we still at that Sugar Hill moment? Part 2 of Detailing the Pyramid starts now.
EPL Talk Pro presents Detailing the Pyramid, looking at the current role of tactical analysis in football coverage, meeting the growing demand. To do so, we're joined by Andy Brassel.
Perhaps I think the influence of Snow could be in there as well.
Michael Cox.
Sorry, there's some building work going on near where I am, so sorry if that interferes with what I'm saying.
Oliver Kay.
Still far more about what's in the mind. It's about the mood, the biorhythm.
Bobby McMahon.
Well, sometimes he gets too much credit, I think, for sometimes being extremely fortunate.
Luke Moore.
It's the sort of thing you guys have to put up with, unfortunately, mate.
Grant Wall.
It's almost like, I would argue, like a graduate-level study of the game.
Richard Whittle.
That a certain crowd is always going to be super into, but is not necessarily totally accessible.
And Jonathan Wilson.
I'd always been very suspicious of it, but I've been on, I think, 3 or 4 weeks now, and there's still a few things I'm sort of finding out.
For For EPL Talk, I'm Richard Farley, part number two of our series, Where We Are. Considering hip-hop's ascendancy as an example of what we see throughout history and culture, we can ask, where are we in this little sub-history of tactics and English language coverage? Because until we can get a good idea of where we are in history, it's almost impossible to tell on which side of a watershed we sit, if there's a watershed at all. When Andy Brassel was asked for his impression of the current state of tactical coverage, the nascent nature of the phenomenon in English language coverage made it difficult to describe without caveats.
I think it's pretty good, but it, as you say, it's pretty new. It's a pretty recent phenomenon. A couple of years is nothing, really. I think if you think Inverting the Pyramid came out, maybe like 2-3 years ago now? Mm-hmm. No time at all. So it's still quite a sort of virgin territory in the UK market.
Grant Wall gives us a US-based viewpoint.
I think there's a lot of demand on it, especially in America. And I'm the first person to say that this is an area where I've been deficient in the past, and maybe US soccer media has been a little deficient. If you grow up in a soccer country where the sport is really deeply ingrained in the culture, and especially in certain countries, I think Italy is especially one that springs to mind, tactics and formations and things like that are part of the daily discussion.
Zonal Marking's Michael Cox, who has been one of the beneficiaries of the U.S.'s hunger for tactics-based coverage, picking up where Grant left off, again using Italy as a benchmark to illustrate why, despite this uptick in interest, English-based coverage of tactics is still lacking.
Well, I think as a whole, especially in newspapers, there's quite little tactical coverage, certainly over here. There's kind of the odd column. The Guardian has been quite good. But apart from that, in England, I don't think there is much tactical coverage as a whole in newspapers. It's interesting if you look at an Italian newspaper, specifically La Gazzetta dello Sport, it's very much more tactically inclined. And I guess just because the newspaper as a whole goes into more detail on everything. I think it's a 32-page newspaper that comes out every single day that is dedicated to sport, and I think about half of that every day is just football, because obviously Italians love football, and so there's a lot of tactical analysis on that. But you don't really get the same kind of thing in English newspapers. There's a little bit more on television, but overall I find the tactical element of television coverage and analysis almost non-existent, because it seems like the analysis is often just kind of breaking down the goals, you know, just showing another replay of the goal and saying this defender switched off or something, when actually I think there's a lot more to talk about than that, and sometimes the kind of little things within games can have a bigger impact upon the game than, you know, just analysing the goals. But it seems to be getting more popular on the internet, maybe as kind of a reaction to the lack of tactical analysis elsewhere. So, you know, maybe sometimes the media companies underestimate how much football fans do want to know about the kind of geeky tactical things about the game.
And perhaps that explains why English language coverage of tactics still lags behind. It has traditionally been considered geeky. Though when you listen to Luke Moore talk about the place of tactics in contemporary coverage and the role of the internet in promoting it, it seems easy to argue that the hunger has been there for some time but wasn't being met by the mainstream sources.
I think that people have an appetite for more and more information. The same way they have an appetite for, or they appear to have an appetite for, and celebrity lifestyles of footballers, they would have a sort of craving for more. Real serious football fans would have a more sort of crave, more of a craving for sort of information about football. I mean, how many serious football fans wouldn't love to sit on the Mourinho team talk, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, you can't do that, but what you can do is you can get someone who's a lot more knowledgeable than you to tell you exactly what's happening tactically and how they won or lost the game. So I think it's got a big role to play. When the internet's involved, anything has got a role to play, because it simply gives you the tools to find out about anything you want to find out about. Just to fill you in, I'm from Portsmouth on the south coast of the UK, and I live in London. Michael Cox isn't from London, he doesn't live in London. So I could make a reasonable argument that if the internet didn't exist, I would never know Michael Cox's work or the fact that he ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a massive player. It's a massive player. And as long as the fact that you and I are talking now, I have a shared interest in football. Our lives would never cross if it wasn't for the internet.
No.
Regardless of our shared interest, it just wouldn't happen. everything's a play. It's just such a big game changer that there is a big role for tactics to play, purely because people are so much more used to getting more information over and over again. The insatiable appetite for information around a subject that you're interested in this case football, is all encompassing.
And you would think that interest in more football information, particularly regarding tactics, would lead to some changes in how the game is covered. After all, this is a business, there is a quantifiable and large demand, and perhaps more importantly, there might be a marketplace that's changing, fundamentally. Now exposed to this level of coverage, the public is unlikely to be content with what was being provided before. After all, there is a reason why this demand is being described as a hunger. And so you would think an adjustment from the mainstream is coming. At least that's what happens in most social systems, be they economic, political, biological. Those at the top of the hierarchy are there for a reason, often because they have more resources or are more adaptable. And if they aren't, they won't be at the top for long. So one question I had is whether some of those who have been providing coverage through this boom are changing the way they go about their business. Oliver Kay.
I don't think it's necessarily affecting it. I think I would still look at a football match and watch a football match and digest it in much the same way. And you analyse it technically, tactically, statistically. You look at it in the context that that it's being played, and any kind of backstory that might end up representing the bigger picture. I don't think the coverage has dramatically changed. I think because the amount of coverage of football has changed, and because the game itself has become a little bit more tactical in the Premier League and certainly in the Champions League. I think those are the reasons why there is more coverage.
Bobby McMahon gives us the broadcaster's perspective on it.
I'm not sure I can say it's affecting our work. I think in some cases it's in some of the discussions around Fox Soccer Report, it's allowed us to do some of the things we talked about quite early on, or try to get more into them a little bit earlier on. You know, not quite knowing whether the audience would accept, taking a bit of footage and just saying, look, you know, just watch the little movement from the left-sided midfield player that actually opened up the room for the centre to get the shot away. Little things like that we weren't quite sure people would really accept before. So I think we try and build that in as much as we can. And the other thing, I think, I don't know if you watched the Fox Soccer Report during the World Cup, but we spent a little bit of time trying to lay out formations for people, because we went on the basis that the vast majority of viewers were going to be watching the World Cup and watching teams they had not watched before, and we thought that if we kind of did some research and some analysis on the formations, at least it would give viewers, once again, this kind of general concept to watch the game, or a general framework to watch the game within. That sort of had an impact, I would say, on the way we approach the things like the World Cup.
For Andy Brassel, both in his writing and on World Football Phone-In, there seems to be a excitement in the knowledge, an excitement that he can feed off of.
It's nice to have the feeling that there are like people to discuss it with, and like I said, it doesn't have to be such a geeky thing, you know. Obviously, I sort of speak to a lot of football writers, so you know, it's maybe something that's not so alien to me. But I think the fact that people want to discuss those aspects of the game now is just really fascinating. People come up to you and ask you stuff about players, and you know, how exactly do they play? How exactly would they fit into my team? What sort of roles can they perform? You know, people don't just like ring up the World Football Phone In and go, oh, I've heard my team, Spurs, interested in you know, this French player. Is he any good? people ring up and say, what sort of player is he? How would he balance with our current players? What sort of role would he perform in the side? How would he improve it? Who would he cover for? I think that's fascinating. You know, it just like opens up the debate a little more. As I said, so I think the fact that, you know, you do feel people are a little more amenable, a little more interested, means you can sort of get amongst it a bit more. I think that's only a good thing.
Overall, there was an acknowledgement of the new landscape, though there wasn't a lot of tangible evidence that coverage is meaningfully changing, which may explain why, once you get beyond the success of Jonathan Wilson's experience, the biggest beneficiary of the demand for tactics coverage is a source outside the established media, though that is starting to become a strange description as it concerns zonal marking. Michael Cox's site is just over a year old, but it is already well established. It is the one site out of a sea of chalkboard adorning blogs to become the hub for tactical discussion. Iconic in its simplicity, almost all of Zonal Marking's posts are a formation diagram accompanied by a synopsis of each team's approach and how the match unfurled. Abstract, details, then conclusion. Every once in a while, Michael provides thoughts on tactical trends or what we learned pieces about prominent teams. If there's a big match somewhere in the world, be it in Europe or even the A-League or MLS, Michael's likely to have a breakdown. And it's those breakdowns and the straightforward, easily accessible nature of them that has made Michael second to only Jonathan Wilson when talking about major influences in this movement. Here's Michael, here's me, from late 2010.
Before we get too deep into this, I wanted to first congratulate you on the success of the site, because to my knowledge, your site is less than a year old, right?
Yeah, it is. I set it up kind of officially in January this year. Before that, I kind of trialed it with a separate blog, which started in, I think, last October. But yeah, I only registered the domain name in mid-January this year. So yeah, it's taken off quite quickly.
My first reaction was like, oh, yeah, this site is going to be really successful. It seemed like there was a hunger for this out there. Were you picking up on that hunger when you started the site, or was this more like a purely personal venture?
A bit of both. I mean, obviously, it was something that I was interested in personally. I think, yeah, a little bit of kind of business sense came into it, just because it seemed like a bit of a gap in the market. You know, there was obviously a lot of people interested in tactics and interested in stuff, what happens on the pitch. But there didn't seem to be any sites that were specifically focusing on it and featuring kind of regular articles, looking at games and breaking them down. So it was a bit of both. It was something I wanted to do, but it was also, I mean, if someone had, you know, been running a very similar successful site before I'd started, then obviously I wouldn't have done it, because it probably wouldn't have been successful as there wasn't that gap in the market.
Hmm. One of the curious things, and we talked about this in our email exchanges, your decision to give yourself some anonymity when you started out, just present yourself as Zonal Marking and not present yourself as Michael Cox. What were the motivations behind that?
Just because it wasn't really any kind of specific decision, but I mean, the kind of the pieces aren't really written in first person. You know, I don't really say things like, I think this, or in my view this. So it kind of almost wasn't relevant who I was, because it didn't really kind of, the content didn't really relate to who I was. And also, I just think it was, you know, nice to kind of have a little bit of, not anonymity as such, but just to be almost coming at it from people thinking neutral in a way. I mean, I'm, you know, not necessarily neutral on anything I write about, because obviously I have an opinion on anything I write about, but equally it didn't need to be kind of a blog that was kind of overarching with, this is someone's opinion, you know, this is, I'm presenting it from my point of view. So I think you need to be kind of neutral, and you need to be seen to be unbiased, I think. So it kind of made sense to come at it from a slightly anonymous viewpoint, I suppose.
When you're answering this, I realize that maybe I've built an assumption into this production that I'm going through for this series of podcasts right now. Maybe I'm assuming that the hunger for tactical analysis is bigger than it is merely from the vantage point that we sit. You mentioned the internet. Obviously, you and me too, we sit right in the middle of the internet discussion, which is relatively dense with tactical analysis, depending on where you want to surf. Do you think that there is that divide between what we discuss on the internet and what is discussed in other media? Is this tactical revolution that I'm seeing, am I overblowing it?
Well, I mean, I think it's a difficult one because, I mean, the good thing about the internet is that it's pretty unlimited in that you can, you know, the website I have kind of is very niche. It's about a very specific thing. And even though I have, you know, quite a big audience these days, that's still doesn't necessarily mean that if it got put into the pages of, you know, the Times or something over here, it doesn't mean that a high percentage of people reading that newspaper would want to read it. I mean, to be honest, I really don't know. I think it's possibly the kind of thing that can only exist on the internet to a certain extent because, as I say, because it's niche and also because you can do a lot of things on the internet. But obviously you can't do in newspapers. I mean, the great thing that I can do on the website is I can obviously have text, I can have the pictures and annotate them, I can also link to the videos of highlights. And some people, I mean, I'm not this advanced, but there's a couple of sites that I've seen recently that have kind of started analysing the games by kind of using video and kind of editing the video and put things like that onto it. But, I mean, as for the kind of the tactical element as a whole, I think it is growing. I really kind of almost can't comment on how big it is because I'm kind of so involved in it, if that makes sense. I think it is big because I'm writing about it every day and people come to the site every day, but I'm sure there's equally people who are completely unaware of this growing movement, if you want to call it that.
And if there is a movement, certainly zonal marking is at its center. A place Michael will share with, amongst others, Jonathan Wilson, who, while noting the undeniable influence of the site, also notes the timing of its creation coincides with the ability of social media to create a wildfire.
Oh, it's immense. I mean, I read yesterday, actually, it was only set up in January this year, and it seems to have been around forever. I can't believe that people... You used to cope without it. I mean, from a very sort of selfish, personal point of view, I find it very useful because if it's a game I've missed, that means I can go back and look at that and find out what I'd have hoped to have been looking for anyway in a game. But also it's quite nice, you watch a game, you have some thoughts, you maybe made notes yourself, you go there and you either find your thoughts confirmed or you find a difference of opinion. And so it's a very useful sounding board for a journalist writing in on tactics. But I just find it fascinating. I find it very encouraging that so many people do enjoy that website, and it does have the popularity that it does. But I think there's been a great exploitation of things like Twitter to sort of... exploitation sounds wrong. It sounds like there's a conscious plan. I think the influence of Twitter has really spread word about the website. The influence of blogs, the fact that it's now common practice for people who are interested in football to read blogs. I mean, yeah, I leave Twitter on all day now and it's kind of constantly looking at it to see what people are saying about football. I'm sure that's true of other journalists, and it's probably true of people who just like football sitting in offices who are a bit bored. But it's not just Twitter, it's other blogs. I mean, today I probably read half a dozen blogs already just to see what other people are saying. And so if they're mentioning or linking to things on zonal marking, then eventually people go and click on it. And once you've seen it, you think, Christ, this is brilliant. This is great. It's giving me something I'm not getting anywhere else. And it's something new. It's very, very good. You know, I wouldn't say I agree 100% with everything, but I certainly agree with 95-96% of it. And even the stuff I don't agree with, it's not because it's sloppy, it's just a difference of opinion. So it's a really professional and very thorough service. And so I think once people do look at it, they tend to go back to it, and then they start telling their mates, they start blogging about it, they mention it in Twitter posts. And that's, you know, It's a real sign of how word of mouth on the internet can generate that sort of popularity, can make something seem that important.
just as the early days of hip-hop produced a lot of music which was the product of an immature genre, the tactical boom is not without issues and implications. At the end of the last show, we talked briefly about numeric annotation, though there are two more general, more fundamental issues that are still being resolved. At least, there are two that we're going to talk about here, the first being something inherent to how the game's traditionally been presented. Is there a danger in finding space within coverage for more discussion of tactics that tactics will be juxtaposed against narrative, and narrative will lose ground? If there is a danger, few see it on the horizon. For example, Grant Wall, somebody who covers the game for an outlet that has traditionally hung its hat on storytelling, doesn't see narrative losing out soon.
You know, I'm not so worried about that, particularly in America. You know, like, Sports Illustrated, that's what we do best, you know? And so I don't see us, I don't see me not doing those things anymore. You know, I've got a lot of freedom to decide how I want to cover things. And, you know, if I'm going to be on site for a U.S. national team game, I'm certainly going to discuss the tactics in my post-game discussion. But you know, I don't think Sports Illustrated magazine's going anywhere. And what I do for that tends to be, you know, much more personality-driven.
For Andy Brassel, the problem doesn't come down to coverage as a whole. It comes down to individuals. And given the new landscape where the internet is such an important distribution medium, there are facets of the system built in that'll help ensure that the demand is met.
That's down to like individual journalists, really, judging if that's the case or not. And, you know, if as you say, with people able to respond so instantly to comment on Twitter and Facebook, if people are unhappy about stuff or they think something's lacking, they'll let you know. And as far as it becoming like, you know, something too important, I don't really think it is yet, because I think really we've touched on it before, like with Jonathan Wilson, we were saying the zonal marking site that Michael Cox does, it's great. You know, they're really the only two flagships. I don't think we're still thinking of a raft of English tactical authorities during the media. And you know, maybe it shouldn't be like that. You know, maybe it's something that, you know, everyone should know a little bit about, everyone should recognize as part of the game.
Michael Cox hints that the change may be less about narrative versus tactics, but trying to define when it's appropriate to use each tool.
But I think maybe there's a little bit less of a need for the traditional match report. I mean, if you've watched the game yourself, and these days if you're a football fan and there's a really big game on, if it's Manchester United-Chelsea, especially I think if you're young and you're familiar with how the internet works and you understand that it's pretty easy to kind of illegally stream almost any game you want, mm-hmm. then I think there's less need for just a match report that says what happens. You know, sometimes I find myself reading it and I kind of feel a little bit underwhelmed because I'm just being told what happened. And I think maybe there's a little bit more of a need to go further than that and to do a little bit of analysis. And so maybe, you know, it is changing slightly in that respect.
So there is a middle ground. And if we are the hungry football audience that Luke Moore describes, we're never not going to want narrative. We want tactical discussions and we want stories. And with more places to access the information and more people volunteering to be storytellers, there should be no need to make tactics and stories into a zero-sum game. As Andy Brassel says, it's down to individual journalists. Tactics and stories need not conflict. And with the other issue that's surfaced from the tactical boom, there is another dichotomy that need not be a conflict. Yet in these early days, there seems to be confusion between formations and tactics. Or better put, too many assuming formations and tactics are synonyms, rather than formation being part of a site's tactics. It's a topic that got Bobby McMahon and I off onto a little bit of a tangent.
I think the other thing that we've got to consider here, perhaps, is that a lot of the discussions that seem to be taking place are not really so much about tactics as they are about
the formations, and I think we tend to get these things mixed up a little bit. I think the English language, the way we discuss it, is we tend to think tactics as formation, and formation is just an element of tactics.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Bob, because that's one of the limitations I'm currently seeing in the coverage. Maybe this is part of the English language catching up to everybody else, but it does seem to me that tactics and formation seem to be synonyms right now. And right now, the dialogue is really based on what the internet community is doing between Jonathan Wilson's columns, Michael Cox's sites, people trying to catch up to that. Formations are very kind of internet friendly. You just throw up a picture and there you go, your article's made.
I got a question last week on through SoccerReportExtra.com, and what it was a guy was looking for tactics books, and obviously he's read Jonathan Wilson's book, and my answer to him was, when you get down to it, if you're looking for formations, there's lots of books out there that'll talk about formations, but there's very few that can actually talk about tactics, because there's one part of tactics which is just sort of general technical ability, you know, how to attack the near post, how to defend against that, how to play a high line, these kind of things that are really transportable from one situation to another. Then there's the other level of tactics which are absolutely unique to the context of the team that you have, the team that you're playing, the situation within the game. You can't write books about that stuff.
That is actually another one of my frustrations with the coverage, is that most of the coverage that we're seeing treats tactics as if you can find the answers in a textbook, where I always prefer to look at tactics as a decision-making process that responds to the situation at hand. One of the things that I always get concerned about is, still, even though we're drifting away from it a little bit, 4-4-2 is a very prevalent formation, but, you know, not every 4-4-2 is the same, depending on what you're going up against. Each of the elements of that 4-4-2 is going to be responding to what the opponent gives them or what the opponent is trying to do.
It's not just the formation, but it's the shape. When you're defending in that formation or attacking in that formation, if you bring a defensive attitude to a 4-5-1, then you're going to look like a pretty boring team. But there's ways of playing a 4-5-1 that then becomes very easily becomes a 4-3-3, but becomes a very attacking formation. So the formation combined with attitude begins to tell you a little bit more. And I think what you get down to really in this is what you're talking about. If you take this idea of tactics or tactics in soccer, really what it is what a business does in their strategic planning. They start looking at their strengths or weaknesses and try and apply it in different situations, and then come up with the answer of how they want to apply their strengths to leverage their strengths for maximum performance, but they want to mitigate their weaknesses and they want to find ways of exploiting the weaknesses of the opposition.
Maybe this owes a lot to the definition Jonathan Wilson had in Inverting the Pyramid, because obviously that's such an influential book. But early on in the book, he has a definition for tactics. He has tactics as the place where formation and style meet. And that becomes very open to interpretation by what exactly do you mean by style. I've always thought of tactics as any decision that a manager or a team makes towards an end.
Well, I would be going more along with your definition as well, because I think the tactics then, you go into a manager would go into a game with a set of tactics that they would want to apply to that situation. Tactics going into a game can change very rapidly within the game and within the context of a game as well. So there is, and this is where, you know, sort of back to this original kind of thought piece, which is formations and tactics being thought of as very black and white kind of elements, when the reality of it's all grey. And when you get into grey areas, it's very difficult to describe, which I think comes back to your idea of, you know, it's very easy and internet friendly to start laying out formations and start inserting little arrows all over the place.
Bob and I are now, well, it kind of sounds like venting, though it's really not. It's just airing some criticisms as much as somebody can in this type of interview without being disrespectful. We both know this audio is going to be used, so we're definitely not letting loose. But as I edited the audio, I couldn't help but imagine two guys not on the end of a phone line, one in San Diego, the other in Manitoba, but two guys having beers at a bar who have come onto a topic they had been stirring in their heads for too long. In truth, a small version of this conversation happened with each of the contributors. Bob and I just indulged it more. But one thing you notice in this conversation, it's also two guys trying to define the parameters of a debate that has either just started or possibly has yet to begin. It's two guys on a stoop in Harlem in 1978 talking about what hip-hop is. It's a bit silly to talk like this, given how long the game has been played, given tactics have always been a part of it. Yet here we are, this new era of English language coverage.
One of the things that I kind of cringe about, and I cringe because it's a little bit difficult to just write it off as this is obviously wrong, is when people say something like, well, formation X is how you respond to formation Y. And yeah. I always cringe because, well, if you have bad players, then it's not going to really matter. If you have really bad players and you're trying to get a result, really what you're probably going to do is have a very, very defensive formation, and it doesn't matter what the other team's formation is going to be.
Well, I'd have two comments on that piece. One is I've been kind of inserting little comments on my pieces about why 4-3-3 always beats 4-4-2. Well, the bottom line is 4-3-3 doesn't always beat 4-4-2. Mm-hmm. If you have better players playing 4-4-2, it doesn't really matter what you play. They're probably going to beat you. And I think the other thing I pick up for this is Harry Redknapp has, I think, got a very, very bad rap. There's quite a, I think, a lot more to Harry Redknapp than sometimes we realize. And one of the things that Harry Redknapp has always been very strong on is the way to improve a team is go out and get better players.
Yeah.
And so if you come back to this situation, if you've got better players, now, then it comes back, then this rolls us back into tactics, doesn't it? Because you get better players, but how do you make better players even better without just constantly having this in and out of transfers? Well, the way of doing it is assessing their strengths, assessing their weaknesses, trying to find situations that you can apply and you can put them in where their strengths are magnified and their weaknesses are mitigated.
But even as Bobby and I talk, perhaps we swing too much in the other direction. At least I do, particularly as it concerns having the better players. Yes, having better players gives you a clear and often decisive edge, but the most talented side doesn't always win. And what bridges that talent gap is sometimes luck, sometimes timing, sometimes the inherent variability of the game, but often it is tactics. And ultimately, out of all the dichotomies and tensions that exist in this infancy of English language tactical coverage, the most exciting dichotomy remains the reason why we watch the matches. What is the plan for taking down the favorite? How does the favorite impose their will on the underdogs? How do the teams match up? And what are they going to do against each other? And tactics are such an integral part of that plan that even now, in the infancy of this boon, it seems improbable that the culture persisted for so long with its paucity of coverage. Yes, at this moment there are conflicts, there are growing pains, but there is also inverting the pyramid, zonal marking, there are people providing an alternative to match of the day goal breakdowns, and there is a consciousness that people want more, and that talented people like Bobby McMahon, Ollie Kay, Andy Brassel, and of course Michael Cox and Jonathan Wilson, amongst many others, they're able to meet that demand. Yes, this moment in the ascendancy of tactical coverage may be that Sugar Hill Rapper's Delight moment that we'll look back on in a few years with as much nostalgia as reverence. But at least we finally have that moment. On the next edition of Detailing the Pyramid, we're going to look towards the future, having already looked towards the past and examined the present. Where is all of this leading us? What kind of footballing landscape are we creating for ourselves with this new focus on tactics? Special thanks to Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan Wilson, you know his work from The Guardian. He also is responsible for Inverting the Pyramid as well as a number of other books. But Jonathan Wilson has just started a new quarterly football magazine called The Blizzard. For more information on that, go to theblizzard.co.uk, where you can also find out how to subscribe. Michael Cox is the owner of ZonalMarking.net, whose work you can also find at SoccerNet.com and The Guardian. Bobby McMahon can be found at Fox Soccer Channel with Fox Soccer Report, as well as SoccerReportExtra.com. Andy Russell's work can be found at SoccerNet.com. You can also find him on World Football Phone-In. Oliver Kay writes at The Times, thetimes.co.uk. Grant Wall is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. Luke Moore is part of the podcast team at thefootballramble.com. And Richard Whittall, you can find at amoresplendidlife.com. All the music featured on this episode of the show is free pod music, featuring the likes of DJ Galesio, Menion, Min Yimian, Swadad, Shatterfreak, Sleepy Town Manufacturer, and Stockfinster. Executive producer of the show is Christopher Harris. The show is produced by me,